Hey, everybody. Happy Tuesday and welcome to the July 7th episode of the Variety and iHeart podcast, The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Coming up today, three very special guests from three very different projects. First up, Emmy Award winner Uzo Aduba talks about transforming into the late trailblazing politician Shirley Chisholm in Mrs. America, the FX series about the fight to pass the ERA in the 70s and 80s. Then Shira Haas. She's one of this year's biggest breakout stars for her work as Esti, the Orthodox Jew who flees her Hasidic community in Brooklyn for a much different life in Berlin. Haas talks about her unlikely start in the business and exclusively reveals the good luck gift her grandmother gave her shortly after she auditioned for Unorthodox. And then I've got Matt Bomer. It's his second time with The Big Ticket. He's here to chat about his work as a serial killer in The Sinner, plus find out about the time he was in talks to star in Call Me By Your Name. We have a big show coming up. You don't want to miss it. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Uzo Aduba won two Emmys for her work as Suzanne Crazy Eyes Warren on Orange is the New Black. And now she's in the running for some new television gold from Mrs. America. The FX series about the fight to pass the ERA in the 70s and 80s is an ensemble led by Cate Blanchett as right-wing firebrand Phyllis Schlafly and Rose Byrne as liberal icon Gloria Steinem. Aduba plays Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to be elected to Congress in 1968. And the first woman to seek the Democratic presidential nomination in 1972.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, how are you? Long time no see.
How are you in the world upside down?
I am doing okay. Like, the days are ever changing, I guess I would say. It's like, the feeling, in terms of the feelings.
Yeah.
Let's move this closer. Because, you know, I will say that, like, supreme, the top feeling that I have is hopeful. But then, like, the feeling right under that is the question, why? Why all to all of it? Why another death? Why are the cases, why are we not wearing masks? Why do the cases continue to go up? Why are we digging our heels in the sand to make a point? Why are we not leading as a leader should? That is my underlying, that is the underlying symptom to me being okay, you know?
So then what makes you hopeful then? If there's all these whys with no answers.
With no answers? What makes me hopeful? What makes me hopeful is that it's more than a hashtag. It's more than a post. That it hasn't stopped in terms of the insistence and the persistence coming out of everybody. Mm-hmm. Because I think in any other season, I know this is the thing everybody's talking about, that perhaps it was a COVID was necessary for all of these awakenings to be happening from, you know, you think about it, it feels almost like decades ago when we started COVID and we were talking about how the planet was changing just from everybody being inside, you know, and you were here, I don't know about you, but here in New York, you know, let's say a week, 2 weeks in, I felt like I was back in my hometown. All the birds I was hearing every morning. literally. It would be like, doo, 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 doo. And I was
You're like, wait a minute. Pigeons? Pigeons sing?
Do they sing? They've got quite a voice, you know, like that kind of. You've got quite a tune. You know what I mean? Like literally. And still. You know, it's that sound everywhere where you would see all these, you know, news stories about the, you know, the planet sort of, I don't know if cleansing itself is the word, what, but that feels like miles ago. And now we're watching this next cleansing that's happening that also feels important. And that gives me hope, you know, I think I feel hopeful. Because of the disturbance and the disruption feels advancing and progressive in the end. If people who are insistent on seeing change, my friend said, this is now probably I don't know, maybe like 3 weeks ago. I said, I mean, it just feels like the world is turning upside down. And I said, you know, I don't know if the world is turning upside down or if the world is turning right side up. You know, I think it might be turning itself right side up. And either way, that feels, you feel a shift. Yeah. And, you know, and it can be easy to mistake that as not good. But I don't know. Maybe it's a Pollyanna in me. I don't know. That feels like a good is coming.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, obviously I've spoken to you. I've spoken to a lot of people in the last, because that's all I do. I sit at home and I talk to people. But it's, everyone is hopeful. I think you have to be. If you're not hopeful, then where are you at?
That's right.
You know, if you're not hopeful, it doesn't encourage you to move forward into mm-hmm. action. Because mm-hmm. it's, if you're not hopeful, you just sit there. And it's like, it is mm-hmm. what it is. Mm-hmm. But I also think, like you said, there's a Pollyanna where we want to believe like the world's going to get better. Or like you say, shift right side up. Mm-hmm. And obviously we won't know that until we get there. And who knows if that's in our lifetime.
Right. And that I don't know. But what I do, that exactly, that is what I don't know. But what I do know, young people especially, you know, and I mean like down all the way to teenagers, Mark, mm-hmm. are energized. And the thing that makes me feel hopeful is that they are galvanizing themselves. You know, that they are organizing themselves. It's not, you know, a pocket here, a pocket. They have found a network and a community to really mobilize their actions and make their voices heard. So like, I agree to your point. I don't know whether the final destination is, you know, next week or next year or not, mm-hmm. but I do know that there's no way these remarkable generations that are born every few decades, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know a version that doesn't push something forward.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you look at those ones who just aren't going to stop.
Right. Because it's what would make them stop? What would all of a sudden change all of their outlook to something that's not hopeful, not wanting change? How do you think Hollywood deals with it? We know we get a lot of hashtags, like you said. Mm-hmm. We get, you know, during the protests and during George Floyd, we got a lot of, you know, Instagram posts from studios and from mm-hmm. everyone saying, we've had enough, we have to do better. Mm-hmm. We've heard this stuff before. Do you think it's lasting? And do you think it really will make change in Hollywood?
I think it will have to, because here's the thing, like we just touched on, this next generation, and I think so too, everybody who's now a good portion of who's come before them has been activated. And what we know is maybe like the really, really older set may shift back. But what's clear is these young people are not shifting back, to your point. So I really think what's different about this group is they vote not only in the ballot, but with their dollars. And I think like they recognize their activism is bigger than just tweeting, posting, marching. Mm-hmm. They are savvy and smart and purposeful consumers. And I think whether the industry comes willingly or kicking and screaming, it will have to shift if it hopes to survive. Mm. That is what I think is going. I don't know if X studio, X exec, whatever thing, name one, whatever, is going to themselves be proactively changed. My hope is that one will be smart enough to see the changing tide. And recognize mm-hmm. if I want to be a part of the ecosystem, a surviving member of the global ecosystem, the demands have shifted. Right. And I have to now meet demand. And so the hope is that. And I mean, I've said this for years, like when we started, you know, on Orange, and we were having a conversation about the TV landscape shifting, which has shifted. You know, it feels like, you know, back in 1902, we were living a different way, but it was only 8 years ago.
you guys shifted it. Obviously we've known each other since the beginning of that. And I remember, you know, doing panels with you and talking to you, and it's like having to explain what Netflix was, how it all worked.
Yes.
Like, it just was.
It wasn't
that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago. That's the thing. It's like, it feels like we've always had streaming. You know what I mean? Like, and it's like, it's not even been a decade, everybody. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we haven't even changed hair dyes yet since it's come out. You know, it's like, we're still on the same train, you know? So it's like, but it feels like it because it's so commonplace now, but right. It's totally changed and totally has a different energy to it. And I think that again, going back to this space of hope, that gives me hope that something right. that at the time felt like, what is this? Why are we, what about appointment television? What are we all going to do on Thursday if we're all watching at a different hour? And everybody, you know what I mean? It turned out to be Burger King. You know what I mean? Have it your way. That's like, everybody loved it, you know? So it's like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right? No, it's so weird to even hear you say that because that's so true. It's like the whole thing was like, but do you think people are just going to tune in when they want?
Yeah, ridiculous.
Like that's such a crazy thing.
Yes.
And now Orange is the New Black is vintage television.
Vintage. Yes. Hand me my teeth. Put me for the men. Like that. Like, it's that, you know what I mean? But the industry does shift. And I think, like, I think of all of these things, like, my hope is that it is style and not trend. You know, that's the thing. Like, as we put up these amazing statements and say that we're in support of change and inclusion, and now, you know, really what's being sought after is real equity. Like, as we're saying these things, let it not just be a cool sign and a fierce picture. Let it be action behind it that is style, everlasting style. You know, like right. a Chanel suit will never go out of style. A crisp button down white shirt will never go out of style. A fabulous red lipstick will never go out of style. Acid wash jeans are a trend. Birkenstocks are a trend. Do you understand?
Do not start with my Birkenstocks.
I have them too, but I'm not sure if in 10 years from now I'm going to be wearing them. You know what I mean? Right. And I want all of these things that we're seeing shift be styles and not trends. Right. I mean, this is entertainment, for goodness sakes. It touches in culture. It should be the forward moving thing.
What I'm curious is, do you find yourself being creative during this time? You know, I spoke to Kenya Barris, and he said he had trouble writing at the beginning. He wasn't inspired. But then I've spoken to other people who say, this has inspired me. I've sat down and written and, you know, things like that.
It has inspired me, I will say. It has inspired me. It's upped my energy. I think if I'm being really honest, it has reignited my passion in a way that was there or maybe had dimmed some. Mm. But it's like the flame in my stomach is hotter somehow. Mm. I think also it's made me think about what everything I've kind of, not even kind of, everything that I have said and meant and wanted before in terms of worth and being enough and not changing myself in any way. If this makes sense at all, it has made that for me as an artist and a visible person even understand that even more as a form of activism. Mm. That my work in that way is activism. That it's even more important now to really hold on to that and love it and stand firmly, straight, long neck, spine in it. Because I am a visible person, my job now is even that my work is at my activism and, and holding space in that way, because for every person who has tried to fit their circular self into a square peg, you know, to feel less invisible. Like that, I don't know how to even fully frame it, but that it's become almost like the driving charge when I look at scripts now and read and write and what I as an artist want, the work I want to be seen in and the stories I want to tell. And is this giving visibility to people, or is this making us, helping to keep us in an invisible place?
And when you look back at Orange is New, the New Black, talk about activism, Poussey. Poussey is murdered by a correction officer with his knee on her back.
And literally.
Yeah. And what happened at the prison? There was an uprising and there was protest. Mm-hmm. It's pretty, but as we know, you know, those stories are not new. Mm-hmm. No, it's not surprising that Orange is the New Black had that storyline. But when I think about that, and I remember watching the episode and being tearful, and now look at where we are today.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and that's the power of art, isn't it? You know, like it's the reason why, you know, when the trouble comes, as they say, trouble no come, as they say in Nigeria. When the trouble's coming, it's the first thing that people try to block, right?
Right.
Because it can inspire and it can, and it tells the truth. When done well, it tells the truth.
Yeah.
And holds that mirror up. It's a hard time to look at it sometimes, but it holds it up. And we see everything from, I mean, in that storyline down to the storyline, you know, our final season of immigration here in America, you know, and then flash forward, people were like, this almost like, how did she write, Jenji, write this story out? And now here we are looking at like these ICE prisons, you know what I mean? Like, and it feels like we're happening in real time, but that's the power of art. And I think that's what excites me of this time. Like, I don't know if everybody's sitting down, you know, and creating in this moment. Some people are, myself, are feeling inspired. Some people are not. And I actually don't think there's anything wrong with that, but it's impossible. I'm so excited. I don't mean the day after we get out of here, but I mean in the years to follow, because we are all forever shifted, you know, like as we're turned, you know, we were here and as the planet turns around, we're now going to be here, hopefully here. And it's like, what is going to be born out of that? What ideas, what stories? It's going to be cool. I think it's going to be really, really great.
So let's talk Mrs. America.
Okay.
Which, as you know, I've told you, Fabian and I sat on the couch and just watched it in one weekend. Like we didn't stop. Like it's my jam. I love American history like that.
Yes. Yes.
It's just, I love the way it was told with each episode, that story of someone else, but everyone else was involved. Mm. What did you know about Shirley Chisholm going into the project? How much did you truly know about her? Did you have to do a deep dive?
I had to read, in terms of like her policy and things she had enacted, I learned more about that and her work as an actual, you know, political figure, congresswoman. But the first time I'd ever heard her name was from my mom, because my mom was like a Shirley Chisholm. And like, you know, all I knew, like, as a kid was, you know, like her talking about her when she came to America and being like, my fighting Shirley Chisholm, you know, like that was like, what? I was like, she's mine too. I don't know what that means, but like, and I don't even know who that is, but I'm fighting Shirley Chisholm, you know? And then when I moved to New York, I had bought this book called An African American Century. And it was chronicling, you know, monumental figures throughout time. And she had a chapter. And that was when I learned why she was such a historical figure and significant individual. And I had never, and I did not know that she had run for president. And, you know, and I'm talking like we're standing maybe like right on the heels of, you know, an Obama campaign right. Bid. And so I was like, there was a black woman who ran for president. You know what I mean? Like that sound, and she did it in the 70s, you know, like that even sounded crazier. And then I did more of a dive. I was reading, I read a lot of her speeches, and I watched her documentary, Unbought and Unbossed. And I was really interested because a lot of the images and the YouTubes that I was seeing, you know, it's like, we know the hair and we know, you know, the glasses and we know the loud clothes, we know all those parts of Shirley, that fake symbolic, you know, image of her. But she was always like in the space of her exceptionalism that was required of her to even be considered right. for the office, both that she held and that she was running for. And I, being familiar with, you know, this idea of Black exceptionalism, like, I'm actually really more interested in like the person, like who is she when this hair right. comes off? And, then I watched the documentary Unbought and Unbossed. And I don't know if you've seen it. If you see it, you should watch it. It's amazing because you really do understand like what mountain this woman was up against. And at the end, I'm talking like the end, like the last 10 minutes. It's where she's conceding her delegates, releasing her delegates and going to concede. And she bursts into tears in her hands. And I just remember thinking like, oh, that's Shirley Chisholm. You know, that, and there was another scene where she's dancing and she has this like fun personality inside her and like a little like, you know, like precocious smile always, like, you know, that she gives, like she's laughing at something in her head. But I remember when she was crying there and I thought like that is Shirley Chisholm. And that is the person I'm interested in knowing. Cause I can watch, you know, I can do this YouTube version of her that I'm seeing, but right. it's like, but who is the person? You know what I mean? Who is that person? Mm. So then it became like reading her speeches to really get a sense of what it was, her mission in doing all of this. And who was right. she? Who was she? Not just what did she represent, but who was she?
So who was she?
She was, great question. she was a woman who had an entirely different definition for herself than the definition the world tried to impose on her. You know, when you listen to her speeches are all about possibility. You know, she was actually like the original hope agent.
I was just going to say that.
You know, and it's always about possibility. And when you start thinking about it in the context of somebody who is serving in Congress in 1968, standing on the heels of the Civil Rights Act, assassination of Martin Luther King, right? Malcolm X, March on Washington, all these things are like happening in the same year and time, you start to realize how ballsy a thing. Like, running, who gave you that bad idea. I know, not a neighbor. Like, that's when you start to, you know, like, it, you didn't look to woman X before you who did it. Right. You know, there was no one who'd done it. And so you start to realize the ideas that existed at that time for Black women, for Black people, that whatever those limitations were, she did not subscribe to those as truths. And that then, and you know, connected to her speeches, that tells you the strength of that woman, the metal that she's made of. You realize the opposition she's up against daily. Pick a box, right, you know, that she's experiencing. And I know what that feels like, to feel like you know who you are and your definition of who that is, and feeling like an entirely foreign definition is being sold to you of what you are capable of. And those aren't always easy days. You can go out into the world and have game face, but sometimes you go home and those can be hard days. It's a heavy lift. It's a heavy lift. As strong as she is, it's a heavy lift. And just trying to, yeah, can't even imagine it.
If you could ask her one question, what would it be?
If I could ask Shirley Chisholm one question, do you think you did it all? Did you do all that you came here to do? I think she did. You know, it's a really yeah, I would ask her that. Do you think you did it all?
It's really good. So what was it like putting on that wig, putting on those clothes, the glasses, the bag, the little heels, the walk that you did? It was just even in the way you were walking through the halls. It was like, obviously I didn't know her, but it was just like, Uzo wasn't there. That was
no, thank you. But it was a lot. You know, our wig supervisor, Ann Morgan, she was so great. She gave me a practice wig for Shirley before we started, you know, probably like 2 months before we started. And that was actually the thing that I thought was so great, like, was like the idea of looking one way in the day and going out into the world in another. And it became like, that was like my practice in the morning, would be putting it on, fixing something to your head, make sure it doesn't slide any which way, make sure it doesn't fall off, slip back, you know, all of this. And, then when you're taking it off, like the work of taking off and then you taking off the wig, excuse me, and realizing like, oh, this is her armor. No wonder why she had so much stuff on, one, to protect herself. Mm-hmm. And then two, the other part, I was like, oh, you know, going back to realizing who this woman knows who she is, it's like, oh, she had to wear these bold clothes, or else she would not be seen. She needed to wear this big of a hair, or people probably would not see her. Mm. They probably would not see her, because if you even track women her age of the time, that was not what they were wearing. Mm. But she had to, she was bold. She was, you know, big. She, while still being graceful and gracious, but she was strong, you know, but she also was aware of the world in which she operated in. And she knew that she's about this big, and she knew she, and she knew she needed to be not only heard, but seen. Mm. It's important to be seen.
Did you ever go off set as Shirley? Like go over to Starbucks?
Yes, but I didn't get out of the car. I didn't really, in all honesty.
Kate Blanchett.
Oh, divine.
What I kept saying about it was, she's Kate Blanchett. You can't forget it's Kate Blanchett. But you forget it's Kate Blanchett.
Yes.
But it's Kate Blanchett. It's this weird, like.
Yes.
I don't know how to explain it in actor talk, but like, she's Phyllis Schlafly. It was genius.
Yes.
But you knew it didn't matter that you knew it was Kate Blanchett.
You only pop out to know that it's Kate Blanchett to give her her props that it's Kate Blanchett. Right. It's like I'm stepping out because it's like this woman is unbelievable. Like it's like I'm popping. I mean, I'm now like popping out for a minute to give you your applause because you deserve. You're giving an 11 o'clock number version level performance. You know, she was. And is phenomenal, like brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
What did you know about Phyllis Schlafly?
I didn't know much about Phyllis Schlafly. The first time, if I'm being perfectly honest, I'd ever heard her name was when I heard that the current president was going to eulogize her. And I was like, who is that? And I didn't know, I had no idea. And just like did a quick Google. This was a couple of years ago. And I was like, oh, and it still didn't, you know, turn my ear.
I love it. Uzo, it's so good seeing you. I hope we get to see each other in person one day.
I know, when we're out of the shutter of the shutdown. See you, see Fabian.
Stay well, stay safe.
You too. Bye. Take care, stay hopeful.
That was Uzo Aduba. I'm going to take a short break, but when I return, Hollywood newcomer and star of Unorthodox, Shira Haas. I'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Shira Haas is 25 years old and lives in Tel Aviv. But when the world is right again, we'll be seeing a lot more of her in Hollywood. Haas stars in Unorthodox as Esti, an Orthodox Jew in Brooklyn who flees her Hasidic community for a different life in Germany. Unorthodox was an instant hit when it premiered in March. I recently caught up with Haas from her home in Israel.
How are you doing?
All good. Day by day.
Where is Tel Aviv right now in terms of lockdown and quarantine?
Well, it's better now, you can say. Places are opening and people are going outside with masks, of course, but places are open now. There are still people that get sick, so there's like people are afraid that there might be like a second wave, but I hope it will stay. I mean, it will get better all over the world, but also here. And that's it. Are you in LA?
Or LA. New York? In LA. So now you have to wear a mask when you're outside in LA. It's mandated by the government.
Yes.
And they're worried about a second wave because numbers are up. It's so unpredictable. We keep trying to say like, this will happen in September or August. And we literally have no idea.
Crazy. So really.
So let's talk about you.
Yeah.
First of all, you did that wonderful Q&A with Jessica Chastain, and she is absolutely one of my favorites. I met her, she had just finished The Help, and I didn't even know what The Help was.
Wow.
And I've spent a bunch of time with her. I was at the Maui Film Festival with her at one time in Hawaii, so she's definitely my people.
Yes, same here. Really, only love. I mean,
so you grew up in Israel. When do you decide I want to be an actor?
Pretty late. No, I mean, I was a very shy child, believe it or not. Even if it's hard to believe, I mean, I was into writing and I loved watching movies and I loved theater, but I never thought I'll be like in this profession of like being in the center of attention, right? I was really shy. Going on stage seemed like an awful thing for me. It's like, I don't know, shows that we did in school and stuff like that. But then I went to a theater major in high school. And I really loved it. But it was more of a hobby, you know, something like that. And then a casting director approached me on Facebook, actually. That's not a good message, maybe, but that's the truth. she was really, really known one. I Googled her, so it's safe. And she was casting a movie. And I didn't have agents, I didn't have anything, but she just told me that you see that I studied this major and she thinks that it can work out. And I went there and it was my first movie. It was Princess.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's how I got into it. And after that, I had my agent finally, and the audition after was for Stiesel. And also, after that, I got a lot of no's, right? But that was kind of like the magical beginning. And I really fell in love with it. I think in Princess, in the first movie that I did, I really like, it was kind of like, I always say that it feel like it's Narnia, you know, the door that's open. I'm like, oh, so that's what I really want to do. I mean, I was 16 and a half, and it was a very powerful experience, really. An amazing director, so yeah.
Was this anything that was in your family or your family in the arts? Anybody, an actor, singer, musician?
No. my whole family and my mom especially, she really loved movies and theater, and I always, from a very young age, we went together to some shows and musicals, and we watched movies together. So it was always there, but not like as a profession, not at all. But they were super supportive. I feel like I always felt like, it was always kind of like her dream, that in a way that she didn't do, to do something with it. And she never pushed me to do anything, never, never. But the fact that I kind of like wanted to do it, she was really supportive and amazing. And my father as well. I mean, as long as I'm happy, they're happy. So I have a really great parent, really.
So yeah. You're 16 years old. This casting director hits you up on Facebook. What do your parents think? What do they say?
First of all, it's something like, who's this lady? What the hell, you know? And I remember I didn't, it's such a long time ago, but I remember I didn't answer her because it was strange. And then like a day or two after, she wrote me, listen, I'm serious. You can see my previous work. And I searched it and I saw her pro. I mean, I did my research to understand that it's a real person, you know, and my parents as well. And they were involved, and then I just went to this audition. It was basically the first on-camera audition that I did. And I guess it worked. yeah. And then I had also, of course, more stages after that, like a callback and chemistry test, and I met the director. But yeah, that was the beginning.
So obviously you've had huge success in Israel as an actor. But then comes along Unorthodox.
Yeah.
were you even able to prepare yourself for the phenomenon? You know, my husband and I, we watched it in one weekend. I mean, you just couldn't stop. Were you prepared for the attention and it just became this moment that everyone was talking about it?
No. I took part in this project and I knew it's the lead role for Netflix. So of course I had like butterflies and I was so excited and I had my dreams and my hopes. But I also always have, when I start a project, I immediately, and I swear it's true, I forget that eventually it will get to people. I mean, which is funny because we're doing it to get to people, right? But when I work on something, I'm so concentrated and you have so many days and so many long days. So I'm always forget about that. But here especially, I mean, I always believe in the show and in the character, of course, but the amount of comments and love and attention is beyond what I even dreamed of in the beginning when I got the news that I got the role. I mean, I was not expecting that. At all. No. I believed in the show and I thought it will work so very well. And I hoped it, and I knew it will get to people, not only Jewish or religious, but to more people, because I always felt like this story is universal. it's not necessarily about specific or to specific people, but the amount of range and different people, different ages, different everything is just, it's really beyond expected, I must say. I wish I was cool enough to say, yeah, of course, yeah.
No, it's good that you don't say that. When you auditioned first, did you know it was for Unorthodox? Had you read Deborah's book? Where, because I, if I'm remembering correctly, Amit told me that he didn't know what he was.
I didn't know. I mean, they just told me that there's, I think, I mean, of course, Amit told you, but they told me audition for a TV series called The Orchestra for a German network platform. So I was like, okay, cool, let's see. And I read the scenes and I thought it's amazing. So I went there and I did it and I felt good and I thought the dialogues were amazing and I enjoyed playing it. And then a few days later, I got a phone call from my agent and she was like, okay, so they loved you. They're coming to Israel in a few days and it's for Netflix. It's called Unorthodox. That was like, I remember exactly where I was and what time it was when I got this call.
Where were you and what time was it?
Okay, so I was in my car. I was about to meet my friend and I just parked my car and I got this phone from her. So I was like, yeah, let's answer it. And then I got it. And I was like shocked. And I remember going to my friend. And I mean, I just told her that even though I wasn't allowed to, now I can say it, but I just told her the truth. And she was very, very supportive. But I was very, very excited. And then also, yeah, a few days later, almost a week later, Maria Schrader and Alexa Karolinsky and Annie Kam, the director and the creator and the producer, came to Israel and we've met. And it was amazing. I felt like it was a workshop because it was like 3 days that I had some chemistry tests with like Yankees and Yaels and Babis, you know. And it was not yet 100% official, but it was there, almost. You know.
Right.
Yeah, well, unspoken wise, something like that. And it was so amazing. And it was like a boot camp in a way. And I had such a great connection to Maria. Yeah, we had such an emotional days of auditioning together. I remember it was raining in Israel. And I remember after the third day, she was about to fly back to Berlin. I went out and she came after me. It was like a scene from the movie. And she was like, thank you. It was amazing. It will be good. Something like that. And I was like, oh my God. Because that's how I felt like it's happening. After that, it was a few days later, I think it was pretty much official and a meet as well and everyone. And it was, yeah.
Yeah, so,
and the preparation started, yeah.
Well, Amit told me, though, I guess it was maybe the night before your audition, the two of you got on the phone, and you did the first date scene in Yiddish. Tell me about that.
So, first of all, the Yiddish thing. I mean, I don't know Yiddish before. And I got the audition on the first round when I thought it's the orchestra. And it was told there, the scenes are supposed to be in Yiddish, but you can also do it for the first round in English. So, of course, I did it in Yiddish. I mean, why not, right? Obviously, I asked someone that I know to record it, and I just learned it, and it was really fun. And then they also looked for Yankees, you know, and I had some chemistry tests, and Amit is, like you know, he's a good friend of mine. And I heard he told me that he's doing this audition and that he was told that he's going to be with me. And I was like, oh, my God. And then we were like, we have to meet. We have to talk on the phone. But since it was a short note, we did it on the phone. Otherwise, we would have just sit together and do it. And we just went on the phone, and it was like, "Aber was auch this?" And "Ich bin nicht wie die andere." You know, like we did. It was so bizarre. And in a weird way, even on the phone, when I didn't see him, but I just felt his voice. It felt so right and so natural.
What do you like about Esti?
Oh. What's not to like, right? every time someone asks me, like, if I'm similar to her, I always answer that I hope. I really think that she's, even though she comes from difficult, you know, circumstances and community regarding her needs, I think that she's very, very present. You know, she's really in the here and now, which we really know about it, and we talk about it, and we read books about it, and we go to psychologists and things. But she's, without knowing it, she's really aware of her feelings, right? She really knows what she feels. She really knows what she wants. She really knows when she doesn't want something. And that's also her curse in a way, right? Because in a world that you need to just fit in, it's hard to have like questions and to be aware of what you feel all the time. So I think that's such an amazing ability to have as a human being in general, to be so aware of it. And I also love the fact that she's so complex, because even when I got like one scene or two scenes in the beginning in the audition, I felt like, wow, like she's both very strong and tough, but also so vulnerable. And she also wants to fit in, but she doesn't want to be there. And she's very like gentle, but you know, she's like everything in contrast in a way. And that's something you need to bring to every sentence almost in this character. And I think that's what makes a character and also a person very, very interesting. And I just love it about her and her curiosity and her generosity. And just, yeah, she's pretty awesome.
How much responsibility did you feel? You know, you're depicting a community that, you know, is very, you know, they're in their bubble. They're in, you know, even like I said, I'm from New York, but it's their separate communities. How do you, what kind of, as an Israeli, as a Jew, do you feel a responsibility to portray it correctly? Because it's, you know, it's an easy thing to just really show the extremes where could, yeah. And that could be, I think, irresponsible. Because there are beautiful parts of being in a community where, you know, you're not worried about the outside world. So how much responsibility did you feel to the Satmar community to do them right?
A lot.
Yeah.
It was a never-ending discussion. In the production, in me, that I shared also with the creators and the director, I mean, you need to root for the lead character in a series. You need to understand her struggles, that's of course. But at the same time, you need to understand, like, to see the whole picture, to show, to have empathy to the place that she's coming from. Also, because, of course, it's more interesting as a story when something is not black and white, it's boring. But also moral-wise, I felt, as a Jewish maybe, as an Israeli maybe, as a person, I don't know, I felt responsibility to bring, like, yes, to say something, to have something to say, because we're doing art and that's part of it. And it's important not to be scared of. And I don't think you ever need to be scared. But at the same time, you need to have a moral vision and sensitivity, because it's real people. And also, like you said, because I think that there are beautiful sides to show, and that there are complexity, and that there are so many like both sides of the coin. So it was always very, very important for us to do that. Also to show Essie happy for a while, even like in the wedding or in the first meeting with Yankee, that she has hope, or with some things with Bobby, you know. And to show kind of like the family together in the scenes, and just to bring some of it. And also when she goes to Berlin, that it won't be like totally woo happy and stuff, but also to have like longing to her previous life. And when she's going through this journey and finding herself, you know, at the end of the audition, she sings the song from the wedding. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's praying. She finds her own God. It's not about this community is bad, God doesn't exist. No, it's about this is it, and I'm finding God inside of me. You know, it's not about good or bad. And it was so important for me. I also have religious people in my family. And in general, I hate generalized people. Right. So I really don't like it. I have like allergy when people do it in general. So yeah, it was definitely a huge thing for me.
And then you have your bedroom scenes with Amit. With Amit. He told me that... He told me there was some laughing going on when you were first in bed together. How uncomfortable? Were you comfortable? This is someone you've known for 10 years. He's a friend. How do you even go there?
You know, it's always a question. I mean, I'm an actress. I had like intimacy scenes before. You know, it's not the first one that I had, but every time it's still, even if you know the person before, even if you don't know, it's kind of like a stage that you need to go through to feel comfortable,
right.
You know, to talk about things or not to talk, but just to feel comfortable to like be you and to say stuff and to act without thinking too much. I think the fact that I knew Amit was really, really helpful.
Mm.
We always laugh that we kind of have like, had like our secret language, you know, we talked Hebrew, so no one understood, right? Mm. They know German and some Yiddish and English, but no one understands us. So wow. It was kind of, yeah. So we always had this and we had our laughs together and we were also very professional. Of course, it was embarrassing in a way. And I mean, we did the first take and we were so serious and into it. And then they said cut. And we really started laughing. And I think I'm a very mature person. I'm not easily embarrassed. But we just started laughing. I don't know. It's Amit above me. I mean, everything. And we're German and English and Yiddish. And we're talking Hebrew. So the whole thing was just surreal. And we started laughing.
And I know you've talked about it a lot, but I do have to ask you about the head shaving. Okay. And your face during that was so real.
Yeah.
How much did you sit there and grieve while it was happening?
So, you know, the truth is like somewhere, the answer is somewhere in the middle, I guess. I mean, like I said, it was on the first shooting day. And first thing was the mikveh scene. So it was not, it's not like the beginning was easier. Anyway, And then there was the shaving scene. So I was like, it was one heck of a beginning. And I started a new production and I'm very, very excited. And I wanted to be good. And I'm happy to do this thing because I was ready for it a long time. I knew about it a long time before, you know, in the audition process. At the same time, I always had like the longest hair. I never cut my hair, never. I always had like the princess longest, really longest. And I love my hair and it's scary. And I don't know. And how does my, even my head shape looks like underneath it, everything together. So even me and Shira, before we started filming it, I really felt like nervous and scared alongside excited, just like Esty in a way.
Right.
But then when we arrived in on action, I remember Maria Schroeder told me, I think it was a few hours before, a day before, she was like, I know that you love to be prepared for scenes, which I do, but she was like, don't be prepared for it too much because there's no right and wrong in that scene. All of the emotions that will come are correct. Mm. And she's right because, you know, you see like 20 seconds of this scene on the episode, but it was like 8 minutes nonstop, right? Two cameras, one take, that's it. So I just had like the roller coaster of emotions. And of course it was also real, but the fact that it was real, but the fact that I was also in control and it happened when I see it, there's a mirror in front of me and it takes time, like 8 minutes. So I felt so comfortable to also play with it, you know, to tune it up here for a while and here. I mean, it was a combination of what I felt and also like the control that I felt during that scene.
When did you realize that Unorthodox was the phenomenon that it was?
You mean in like success and attention wise?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it was like 1 second that I realized it. It was kind of like, not in the first few days, because in the first few days it's happening, it's there on Netflix. You don't really you're like, yeah, I have it on Netflix, you know, but that's it. And it's happening, and you're posting, and you hope that as many people as possible will see it. But then, I think after a week, I started getting so many messages and so many also new followers on Instagram, really, and like also so many emails and compliments from staff from like the industry as well, and also press and PR staff that got there, and boom, reviews. Also the reviews. I mean, all of it together, kind of like, I mean, there were like great reviews also on the TV series and also for the performance. Thank God. And I was like, yeah, okay. So the critics love us. But I mean, it's amazing. It's a lot, but it doesn't say about the people. And then also, I got you kind of felt the people. So it was kind of like a week or two of like understanding that it's kind of like exploding.
Right.
It wasn't 1 second, but it was like every day it was like, whoa. And it was really to my phone because, you know, I was at my home, like all of the world, right? So yeah, that was also interesting.
And so now you have 397,000 followers on Instagram.
But who counts, right?
I'm not. Yeah. So what was your count when you started on Orthodox? And
it was like 20,000, I think. Yeah.
We know you're a cancer survivor. You have grandparents who were in the Holocaust. Those are two traumatic events in anyone's life. Whether obviously you weren't there with your grandparents, how did being a cancer survivor, you were so young, but how does that impact you? Especially when you said that your parents, I think every parent is like this, they just want you to be happy.
Yes.
And my parents always wanted me to be happy. But I imagine it takes on another level when they knew their daughter was a cancer survivor when she was just 2 years old.
Yeah. Well, it started when I was two. It finished when I was about 4 or 5. I always say when people have asked me, like, you're such a hero, you know, how did you do whatever? I always say that I think that the heroes are actually my parents, you know? I mean, I remember stuff, a lot of stuff, but I don't have, like, a chronological events, you know, in my head because I was really, really young. And that's a big hero, I think. You know, it made me who I am in a way. I mean, I don't know. I can't say like my life before and after, like a lot of other cancer survivors, because it's also interesting because I really kind of like, I know myself, like the beginning of my life, I feel like it started there in a way, you know, I don't have like a before. That's like the opening point for me. And I don't say it in a bad way. I think it's really, I mean, of course I'm not thankful for that, but I'm thankful for what it like brought to me. I think, I don't know what would happen without it, but it really made me who I am as a person. I think I was like a mature child. I was like a 40-year-old when I was 8, you know, and I wrote stuff so deep. I mean, I saw a letter that I wrote when I was about 11 and I'm like, calm down, girl, you're just 11. You know? And I think it also helped me as an actress as a well, in a way. I mean, I'm still young, but even when I was 16 and I had to play in Princess, a very tough role, I think that I have the maturity maybe above my age to relate, to understand pain or to understand the character. And maybe it still does help me. And as for my parents, I mean, I think I don't know, to see me, doing what I love and actually doing it, getting good response to it. And I don't know, I think it brings them a lot of life and love. And I don't know, I mean.
So what did you write in this letter when you were 11 years old?
Come on, when you're a child and you're going to like scout, right? When you're like.
Like Girl Scouts? Yes. Like camp, summer camp?
Like camp, but it's like, it's not summer camp. It's like every week. Anyway, it's boys and girls like together. It's nothing special.
Like a youth group. Yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah, yeah.
I'll find the word and I will forward it to you for that if you want to use it. Anyway, I went there and I never did go there. But I remember one time I was like, a friend of mine told me to come. And I was like, okay. And that was actually the first time that it was a very special like assignment that they wanted you to do. Like they wanted you to write a note to yourself in 10 years from now.
And you're 11? You're 11?
Yeah.
And they wanted you to do that?
Yeah. I mean, nothing like too deep, but just write yourself something, you know? And I guess a lot of people just wrote like, what's up? You know, I don't know. But that was my assignment. And I took it so seriously. And I saw it like, not too long time ago, which is more than 10 years, I'm 25. And I just write their stuff like, I hope you're happy. You know, I hope that you find a place that you feel peace. There's not even one word of like acting, nothing.
Right.
I wrote about writing. I wrote about photography because I love to do it. I asked if I study psychology. And I was like, no, actually, no, you know, yeah. Wow. And yeah, a lot of like deep stuff and about my parents and about, you know, like questions, some of the questions I still have now, you know, but just maybe in a different language a little bit. And it was like very amazing to see it. Yeah.
And what about
I wanted to hug myself. Yeah. In a way.
what about your grandfather was a Holocaust survivor?
Yeah.
How did that?
My grandparents, actually, My mom's parents. My mom's parents.
How does that, I mean, I know you can't sum it up. I mean, I can't even believe I'm asking it, but how does that inform you? And then to do a role like Unorthodox is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also had the zookeeper's wife, right? I mean, my grandfather is an Auschwitz survivor, and my grandmother, she's a survivor from Hungary, which is interesting because also Bobby and also Eshi's Bobby and also Deborah's Bobby, they are from Hungary. I mean, Satmar comes from Hungary, so it's crazy. I mean, I don't know. It was always something that's important for me to talk about, you know, especially when the years go. I'll talk about Unorthodox in a second, but it was always something that is important for me to talk about because I feel like as the years gone by, I mean, I have only one grandmother that's left, and she's 90 something. It's something that's always like an unbelievably important for me. And also this year we had like the Holocaust Day also in the, I mean, we also did kind of like a Zoom with my grandmother, yeah, on the Holocaust Memorial Day and also in the Seder and in Passover. So it's also challenging. I found myself year after year trying to, finding the way to still do that. And as far as Unorthodox, of course, it came to my mind. And I remember I came to my grandmother. I think she was actually back then, she's okay now, but she was back then in the hospital. And we just went there, and I talked to her about this project. Well, I never said it in an interview, but I talked to her about this project before it was official that I'm doing it. And she gave me a ring, and she told me that this one will give me like luck, and that she really hopes that I will get this role, and she feels that I'm gonna get it. And it was kind of like her ring that she has for like, I don't know how many years. We're talking about 30 or 40 or something like that, crazy number. And I was so emotional, also because of the gift and what she wished for me, but also because, I mean, when I told her about the show and what it is about, she was just so happy. And I told her it's been filmed in Berlin, which of course, I mean, I love this city, but for her, it might be more difficult maybe.
Yeah.
So, and she was just completely positive. And she just was so proud of me that I'm going to go there, that I'm going to shoot it. And just, she's really like one of the people that are like Esti in a way, but very different, like most important to me. So this was everything. And it's on me ever since.
This was amazing. It was so nice meeting you. Hopefully maybe you'll be here for the Emmys, if there is an Emmys, because I know you can't say.
I don't know. No one can say. Can someone say? Only he can say.
But what does that feel like to hear when people say that you're a shoo-in for an Emmy nomination?
Crazy. No, really. The fact that it's a discussion is amazing. And finger crossed, I wish, you know. Who knows?
And will there be a season
two? God only knows.
Will we see a season two?
I don't know. I can give you the creator's number. I'd love that. I mean, as far as I know, it was always planned to be one season, and they're not planning to do a second season. But I mean, the answer is always who knows.
That was Shira Haas. Unorthodox is available on Netflix. We have one more guest for you today on The Big Ticket. Coming up after the break, Golden Globe winner Matt Bomer talking about the time he was up to star in Call Me By Your Name. And he also talks about shaving his head on camera. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Matt Bomer is truly one of the nicest guys in Hollywood. So I have to say it wasn't easy watching him portray a serial killer in the second season of The Sinner. but he was able to make me forget how sweet he is by playing Evil and Twisted so well. I chatted with Bomer from his home in Los Angeles.
Hi.
Hi. How are you doing in all this craziness?
Day by day, you know, look, we have so much to be grateful for. I'm trying to remember that at the beginning and end of every day and not get sucked into the constant news cycle. I mean, I'm trying to balance like completely burying my head in the sand and actually not getting sucked into a really unhealthy news cycle, which I think is tricky. And, you know, trying to stay productive and keep the kids educated. It's definitely tricky because they learned a different style of math at their school called Singapore math, which we were never taught.
2 + 2 = 4.
It's all about grouping things into fives and tens. I know this is fascinating conversation, but I wasn't taught that. So I know how to solve some of their math homework algebraically, but I don't know how to do it using methodology they're supposed to. So it's been interesting, you know, but they've been such troopers and, you know, so we've been just trying to, you know, use this time to really grow together as a family and for me, I've certainly tried to make it a time when I can help out in any way I can and reach out and connect people and reunite with people, all those things.
So what are you binging? What have you binged?
Oh my gosh, not nearly enough, you know, and you might be surprised by some of that. Well, I would say my two favorites that I've binged, and I know I'm really late to the party on one, was Years and Years, the Russell Davies show from the BBC that came over to HBO. I love that show.
Yeah, that's great.
I thought it was such bold, audacious storytelling that you just don't see every day. No. And the performances were great. I also really love The Last Dance. That Bulls franchise.
Yeah, Fabian has been, I'm just not a sports fan. And I know it's not just about sports, but Fabian, he's such a basketball fan. So he's like, Mark, I watched all these games. I know about all these games. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, no, it was a huge part of my childhood. So to get to be back behind the curtain and have all these players, I mean, they got everybody to weigh in and the footage they got is just insane.
It's incredible. I know, he kept saying, he's like, when could you give me the last episode? I was like, I don't know anyone at ESPN. It's not my beat.
And we finished Schitt's Creek. We finished, Dead to Me. Well, we're on Dead to Me now. Which I really like.
We just started that. We just started season two. Yeah, season two.
But I went on a real like 80s, like 70s, 80s, like Hal Ashby, Mike Nichols binge too. So I would say those movies were just as important to bolster me as binging a show.
I know. We're such bingers. We like, we'll watch one or two episodes and I don't know if it's the addicts in us, but we get addicted and we're like, we've got to watch it now.
What do you, I have a running go list through on a note card here. So what do you have for me?
Okay. Unorthodox.
Unorthodox.
On Netflix. It's only 4 episodes. It's the Shira Haas who plays the young woman is mesmerizing. She's absolutely, you cannot take your eyes off of her. Wow. And then the guy who plays her husband, also Israeli, his name is Amit Rahav. I just actually did the podcast with him. Young, openly gay actor from Israel, who's gorgeous. And it's just this fascinating story. What else have we been? We've been binging Working Moms. Have you watched
Simon that? Is obsessed with it.
Oh, obsessed. Matt, it's just last night I was tweeting. I'm like, Catherine Reitman is a genius.
Yeah.
We literally like laugh out loud, like one of those.
Wow.
We've been watching that. What else did we binge recently? I know we binged, got some new show. We're Here, which is the new drag queen makeover show.
Yes.
Three queens. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then we just watched 2 episodes. It's not out yet, called Legendary, which is a ballroom competition show. So it's like pose competition. What else we watched? Defending Jacob was good. And then we binged Sinner.
You did?
Dude. Yes.
That's nuts. We were so into it. I think it was last week. We ran right through it.
Oh, wow.
And I guess I'll just ask you, like, how do you play someone so dark? Because
Well, I think the first thing you do is figure out how to become that character's defense attorney. I was so lucky to get to work with someone like Derek Simons, who is so thorough and so collaborative and so informative and there for you if you need him. And just building the backstory that led up to when we first meet him, so that once we started filming, I was only ever hopefully seeing the world through his eyes without putting any kind of judgment on it about what's right and wrong or criminal or, you know, legal or any of those things. Cause I think once you start to get in your head that way, you can really, get in your own way.
Right.
So, and I think Derek did a really good job of orchestrating that for me and sort of being a partner in crime throughout it, so that we were only ever really seeing the world through Jamie's eyes.
So let's back it up. How did you get involved, and how does, so a series like this, obviously it's different than the first season. And do you get all the scripts all at once, so you know how the story's played out? Or is it sort of like episodic TV where you're sort of learning it as it goes?
It's a little bit of both. I had met with Derek years ago when he was involved in Call Me By Your Name. And we'd hit it off creatively and had a great conversation. And I was a huge fan of the show from the first two seasons. And I liked what it had to say about trauma and the need to sort of excavate trauma as opposed to repress it and the dangers of repressing it and how deep it went psychologically and what a challenge it was for all the actors involved. And so we met, and he sort of laid out his initial thoughts for the season, and those evolved over time. So the next step was going and meeting with the writer's room a couple months later, and then it was sort of fleshed out and boarded out into episodes. And I had a little bit more intel as to who he was and what the character's trajectory was going to be over the course of the season. And then, you know, I think we got the first two together before we started filming, and we block shot those. So we filmed both of those at the same time. And then we filmed three and four together at the same time. And then it was just sort of getting the script as we went.
Right. But I got to back up though. You just said you met about Call Me By Your Name.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I wish it were a really, you know, intriguing story. It's just that he I think had done the original draft of the script and had the rights. And so we met this was years ago. I couldn't even tell you how many years ago it was. Way before it became, you know, the production it became. I obviously love the material. I love talking with him about it. I thought it had real potential. then he went on to do other things, and I went on to do other things.
So were you Army or Timmy?
Army.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you aren't just something. You knew it was good material.
Yeah.
So maybe you should be a producer.
I think as an artist, you know, if you're fortunate enough that you've been reading scripts for a number of years, you have a somewhat of a sense as to what is intriguing to you, at least as an artist. You know, who knows about commercially and the zeitgeist, that's always changing. Only, you know, you psychic people like Ryan Murphy can predict that.
So you get the script, you know, obviously it has some trauma. What, and I don't know if there's an answer to this, and maybe it's for us to decide for ourselves, but what was that connection with Nick, played by Chris Messina? What did he have on him?
It was a relationship that soothed a really profound sense of spiritual loneliness. It transcended friendship. It was a soulmate connection, but not in a sexual way. I think to speak of it in sexual terms, though they did have a shared brief sexual history would be reductive. Right. It was really more about two people whose self-prescribed ethics soothed a wound that they both had. And so there was a certain sense of loneliness that could only be relieved in the company of each other.
It was the scene when you're cutting your hair and Chris is behind you was just intense, you know, and obviously there's a chemistry, soulmate, sexual friendship. There's the two of you had this chemistry that was just really intense. And I was sitting there and I was like, did I ever have that with anyone? That was so intense. I mean, I hope I wouldn't have something that turned into that, but that obsession, because, but I felt like, was Jamie obsessed with Nick or vice versa? Or was it each other?
And both, was it obsession? I think it was part of Jamie's sort of arc of the season is that he slowly, you know, he was sort of the right-hand man to Manson, you know, and his journey right. over the course of the season that he's becoming Manson. Mm. So it's him becoming Nick. And that actually, not to toot my own horn because it was a huge collaboration. They made it better than I ever could have, but that was actually my idea to do that scene.
Oh, wow.
And to have Nick be the one to cut your hair, which is a very intimate thing to do with somebody. and you're really grateful if you get to work with an actor like Chris Messina, who's just game for anything. Although it's one of the fun things about working with Chris and Bill is that you never really know where the scene's going to go. And that's sort of what makes it interesting to work with them. And so that gets a little bit trickier when you're cutting your hair off, when someone's really cutting your hair off, because you only have so many takes. And we definitely did it.
One take.
Yeah, we had a couple. I think we did two or three different ways, but they were really very different. And I think what they used was sort of a hodgepodge of the different ones we did. But yeah, there is a profound sense of intimacy into it. And it's sort of what I wanted. I almost wanted it to be like a coronation, you know, like of him almost like baptizing me into. Yeah, exactly.
And that was your real hair he was cutting off.
That was my real hair he was cutting off.
Because my Fabian goes, that's his real hair. He's cut it because obviously he's a hairstylist, so we know when people are wearing wigs. He's like, that's Matt's real hair.
Yeah.
That's kind of intense.
It wasn't. I mean, at that point, I'd already lost like almost 20 pounds and was trying to go through this really dark transformation of the character so that he looked like just a shell of a human being by the end of the show. And so it was important to, I think it was an important change for him to make to sort of complete that transformation. So it didn't bother me then. It definitely, you know, I had all kinds of patchy spots in my hair and they were all different lengths. It was like a real self. And credit to the amazing hair department there who did a great job of finishing it up. But when I finished, it was definitely not really something you could fix. And, you know, it was definitely took a while to grow into something that I could actually manage.
What was it like with Bill Pullman, especially this character so in his head? It's very... There are so many shots of him just looking.
Yeah.
Where it's like his eyes are doing the acting. What's it like to do a scene with a character like that where it's so emotional and so intense, but it's two very closed down, shut off men?
Yeah.
Who really don't know, you know?
Yeah. I think that's a big part of what the season was about, was male intimacy. And the dangers of not being able to, of holding things in, holding trauma in, holding your feelings about society, about other people in, and not being able, repressing them instead of sharing them. And then even if it is a misguided opinion. So I mean, look, I love Bill. I had done a film with Bill where he played my father in flashbacks, but I'd never gotten to work with him. And I was like, oh man, I've been such a huge fan of his stage work and his screen work.
When are your kids allowed to watch a show like that with you in it?
I don't know.
How old is the oldest now?
He's going to be 15 next week.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
Wow.
I know. 15. Not the most fun time to have a 15th birthday, but he's been a real trooper about it. So
yeah.
I can't complain. You know, honestly, I don't think they've even watched White Collar. So
really?
No, I don't think they have. Or maybe an episode or two here or there. They
no
all
magic
have
Mike.
No, although I found out that the twins snuck, you know, we were on an airplane and we were obviously not in the same seats, and there are five of us,
no.
So we're not all in the same row, and one of them tried to sneak it on the screen, Magic Mike on the screen back. I was like, no, we are not starting there. We're not starting there. No, I don't know. You know, I mean, I guess my feeling is, I always want to do the best work I can and have a great work ethic and try to set a good example for them and hopefully make them proud. But I don't ever, as an artist, look at my work and go necessarily like, look, I would love to do a voiceover in an animated movie that they'd watch or, Big Mouth or something like that. But it's,
come on, pitch it.
Yeah. Come on, whatever you got. If you got something that's tween friendly, bring it on, people. But I never look at my work as an actor, particularly things like this that I know are really deep dive that are going to challenge me in ways that I haven't been challenged before. And that frankly, when this was pitched to me and I'd watched the show, I thought, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can pull this off believably. And I'm going to have to go deeper and try to grow as an actor to rise to the level of the show. So I think when I take a job like that, or if I'm lucky enough to get a job like that, it's not something that I think, I just think, well, if the kids one day want to watch it, I hope they're proud and they understand. Right. And if they don't, that's okay too.
And then Boys in the Band.
Yes.
I'm finally going to see it.
Yes.
On Netflix.
Yeah.
Have you seen the final cut?
I have not. I've heard, I've had some friends who've seen it, and I'm very excited about it. It was a great experience. You know, it's obviously so different to do a project on film than it is,
right?
You know, it just is. It's a very intimate medium, and things that you could play, you know, that play essentially plays out in one giant master. There are more or less nine guys on stage the entire play, particularly Jim and I.
Yeah.
So to have it then turned into a film and lines that you used to be able to take to the back of the rafters, you know, you can't do that anymore. But I was really excited about it because there were aspects of my character in particular that Joe and I were able to dig much more deeply into because he is the observer in the group. And that's something that I think can play more on film as opposed to on stage when there are nine people on stage at once. Right. And I think there were things that Jim and I found in our characters' relationships that we were able to deepen from the stage run. So it was great to have everybody together, first of all, and really fun, and kind of felt like summer camp, to be honest with you, because we filmed it in the summer. We all knew each other. We had a good rapport. We worked really hard during the day. We laughed a lot. But I think at the end of the day, I'm really excited to see how what we started on stage transformed a bit and then came out on film.
What do you want audiences to get? Is it part LGBT history? Is it a history lesson?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, we don't have a lot of pieces. You know, this takes place in like a couple of months before Stonewall.
Right.
So there aren't a lot of pieces from that time. And it's about that fever pitch. It's about that roiling, that anger that was suppressing itself, that was just about to explode and externalize itself and say, we can't do this anymore. So I think in terms of the material we have to look to, it's really it. I know that there are people who have different opinions about the material and what it says about gay men at the time. But what I always try to remind people of is it's about a very specific group of men at a very specific time. It never was sought out to encapsulate the entirety of the gay experience.
Right.
And so I think Mark Crowley did us all a favor in having the courage at that time to put something like this together unapologetically and to form these really well-drawn characters who were all very different types. I think it's absolutely a piece of our collective history that should not be lost. You know who you look like now is Lucas Hedges.
I
can't be the only person who's told you that.
Fabian, when he cut my hair, he's like, you look so much like Lucas Hedges. Then I was talking to Caitlin Deaver. I was doing a podcast. She's like, oh my God, I've always thought this, but even now more, you look like Lucas.
Yes.
So yeah, I will play his father.
It's good.
In a movie. Thanks. And now a fun question. Your first audition you ever went on, whether you got the role or not, what was it?
Okay, so I had two in one weekend and one job I got and one I didn't. Do you want to hear both or just one?
Yes, both.
Okay.
I want both.
Oh, are you talking about like when I was a grown up or as a kid too?
Whatever came to your mind just now.
Okay, so I'll skip this stuff when I was a kid. Okay. I came very close to getting the Mickey Mouse Club, but that's a very different story. I would have been in that same class with, maybe I should tell that. I went on a cold call in Houston with my best friend at the time, Lynn Collins, who's a very successful actress now as well. And I just sort of tagged along with her and they lined you up and you had to sing a song. I had no song prepared. So I just sang the same song that the girl in front of me sang.
which what was, song do you remember?
It was Eternal Flame by the Bengals. and then I basically just did this, like, I kind of made up this monologue on the spot for the comedic acting part or whatever. And I kept getting called back and called back and called back. I didn't have a headshot. I had nothing. And they called me and they were like, we think we're going to bring you down to, was it Orlando? Is that where they all were?
Yeah, Orlando, yeah.
Orlando, so, yeah. For that, like the screen test or whatever the final callback was. And so I was so excited. I had time to prepare. I got like a real monologue together. I prepared a song and I think I got called at the last minute and they ended up not bringing me down. They're probably like, who is this kid? No one's going to come with him. Like he'd be on his own. But it was really exciting. And it would have been in that same class with Justin and Brittany and Ryan and all those people.
And Kerry Russell.
Yeah. And Kerry Russell.
And Christina Aguilera.
And Christina Aguilera. It was tough competition, well, Mark.
That sounds like it. You went against Britney Spears.
Yeah. Gosling. I mean, come on.
Oh, that's right. How old were you?
I want to say I was in seventh grade. So what are you, 12? 13?
I'm 12,
13.
Yeah. 12, 13.
13, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You sang the Bangles.
I sang the Bangles' Eternal Flame. Listen, what are you going to do?
But look at you now.
Look at me now.
Your life would have been much different.
Yeah. Yeah, truly. Truly. I mean, I look back on all those early experiences where things didn't pan out and I think, oh my God, ultimately for the most part,
for a reason.
Thank God.
Yeah, and you get that with age. I mean, when you're in your 20s and something doesn't work out, you're like, my life can't go on.
Yeah.
And now I think about those moments, I'm like, thank God that happened.
Yeah.
Someone was looking out for me.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Romer, this was so much fun.
Yeah, stay safe, stay sane. Try, you too.
That was Matt Bomer. And that's it for today's episode of The Big Ticket. Coming up tomorrow, Oscar winner Charlize Theron will be chatting about her new movie, The Old Guard, homeschooling during quarantine, and so much more. Until then, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mark Malkin. And for all your up-to-the-minute Hollywood news, head over to Variety.com. Stay safe, be well, and don't forget to wear a mask. See you next time.